Today is Thursday, April 18th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, President Trump confirms that the director of the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency met with North Korea's leader. The Federal Aviation Administration orders the inspection of jet engines following a Southwest Airlines flight explosion.
There have been over 30,000 of these engines made. They really are a workhorse of the industry in terms of aviation transportation.
Also ahead, a major societal change comes to Saudi Arabia. It's all on today's International Edition. President Donald Trump struck an optimistic tone on Wednesday about the possibility of a denuclearized North Korea. Trump says the United States has begun direct high-level talks with North Korea. The president said U.S. Intelligence Director Mike Pompeo got along really well with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un during a secret meeting in Pyongyang. Trump confirmed that Pompeo recently traveled to North Korea to meet with Kim. Officials say the secret meeting was held in preparation for a possible summit between Trump and Kim. At a news conference on Wednesday alongside Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, Trump told reporters he's looking forward to the meeting.
As you know, I will be meeting with Kim Jong-un in the coming weeks to discuss the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. Hopefully, that meeting will be a great success, and we're looking forward to it. It would be a tremendous thing for North Korea and a tremendous thing for the world.
The Washington Post, which first reported Pompeo's meeting with Kim, said it took place over Easter weekend, shortly after the CIA chief was nominated to become Secretary of State. Trump is planning to meet with Kim by early June with a goal of getting North Korea to agree to denuclearize, a situation that poses a growing threat to the United States and its allies in the region.
We've never been in a position like this with that regime, whether it's father, grandfather, or son. And I hope to have a very successful meeting.
Abe, who visited with Trump at his Florida resort, praised the president for agreeing to hold the summit with Kim, saying it took courage. VOA's Victor Beatty asks Jeffrey Hornung, a researcher on Japan at the RAND Corporation, if it now appears more likely this meeting will really actually take place.
Before, there were questions about whether this was going to really happen, since it was the South Korean delegation that announced it. But the announcement that Pompeo had gone there confirms the fact that the U.S. is, in fact, moving forward with the summit with Kim.
Do you detect a change in North Korea's behavior?
I'm skeptical about that. The one thing that people need to keep in mind always is that what denuclearization means differs. So the U.S. and even Japan tend to look at denuclearization as complete, verifiable denuclearization, whereas North Korea looks at denuclearization from the standpoint of all nukes gone from the peninsula. This includes the U.S. nuclear umbrella. And so I think when you have negotiators sit down and when you do have the summit actually occur, they might come to the realization that their definitions of denuclearization differ.
The president also indicated that negotiations are underway for the release of three Americans held as prisoners in North Korea. This is something that really has been under the radar and hasn't been talked much about.
Yeah, I think here, if you look at what success could mean for a summit, you're going to probably look for some broad announcements, some basically ambiguous announcements, but also something that is specific, that would be tangible evidence that maybe some success has been made by both sides. And so something like the release of prisoners would be that low-hanging, tangible evidence that maybe the North Korean regime wants to show to the U.S. that's serious about talking.
And an issue that's very close to Mr. Abe is the issue of Japanese abducted by North Koreans. Mr. Trump said that's on the table as well.
Yeah, so this is obviously from the Japanese standpoint, they have three priorities for Mr. Trump. They're the same with the U.S. in terms of denuclearization and the ballistic missile program, basically scaling that down or abolishing that. But the third is Mr. Abe has made really a career out of trying to pursue the abductees that North Koreans have taken from Japan since the 70s and 80s. And he came here with a goal of making sure that Trump knew about this and that puts it on the agenda when he meets with Kim. And Mr. Trump has said that he would. But I think there's still some skittishness within Tokyo about whether or not, if it comes down to a hard negotiation with denuclearization versus abductees, there's still skittishness on whether the U.S. would fulfill that.
That's Jeffrey Hornung, a researcher on Japan at the RAND Corporation. Well, the Federal Aviation Administration here in the U.S. is ordering the inspection of some 220 jet engines after investigators said a broken fan blade touched off an explosion that ultimately led to the death of one passenger on Tuesday on a Southwest Airlines flight from New York to Dallas. The plane made an emergency landing in Philadelphia. Thomas Anthony is director of aviation safety and security at the University of California in Los Angeles. He says these are widely used engines.
Even though it first came into service in 1982, it actually was in development in the 1970s. So there have been over 30,000 of these engines made. They really are a workhorse of the industry in terms of aviation transportation. And they serve as the engines for the 737 and the Airbus 320, which, again, are the real workhorses of aviation transportation. So a lot of them have been made. And then just for another degree of context, these CFM56 engines, they log about 1 million hours of usage every 8 days. So in the history of the last several decades, they have been very reliable and have been depended upon for carriers all around the world. So yes, they are very numerous and we rely upon them every day. In fact, the United States Air Force has re-engined their KC-135s with this engine.
Well, there are thousands of these engines out there, but why are only a few hundred currently under examination?
This indicates that the FAA is interested in a certain lot of engines in terms of a production run. That's what I see from this. You don't make all 30,000 engines in a continuous run. And additionally, the materials and the manufacturing processes are different. You may buy your titanium from one supplier for 5 or 10 years, and that supplier goes out of business. Or you may use a forger for 10 years, and they are bought by a new company. So we really don't know, but certainly there were some changes or something in particular, either about the method that they were manufactured, the way they were installed, or the materials they were made of, or the processes. It is just amazing how many particular specific operations and processes and inspections go into one single part that is of many thousands of parts in an aircraft engine.
Well, investigators have the airliner's flight data recorders and will likely have to take the damaged engine apart to examine it before determining the actual cause of the deadly mishap. And turning down now to the latest on social media, we hear from VOA Sarah Williams for more on the pilot of that plane who's being hailed a hero.
Well, one passenger died and 7 were hurt Tuesday when an engine aboard a Southwest Airlines flight from New York to Dallas failed. It forced the jet to make an emergency landing. Officials from the National Transportation Safety Board have not said the cause of the female passenger's death. But witnesses said engine parts hit a window and the woman was almost sucked out of the jet before pilots made the emergency landing in Philadelphia. The dead passenger was identified as Jennifer Reardon of Albuquerque, New Mexico. The Wells Fargo Bank executive was the mother of 2 and the first passenger to die in a U.S. commercial jet accident since 2009. Well, trending on social media is hashtag Tammy Jo Schultz. Well, many are calling Tammy Jo Schultz. She landed the Southwest flight 1380 after it lost the engine a hero. The Navy veteran is being compared to famed pilot Sully Sullenberger. Julie tweets, when she tried to attend an aviation career day at her high school, she wasn't allowed to go because they didn't accept girls. She was one of the first female fighter pilots in the Navy's history and the first woman to fly F-18s. And today, Tammy Jo Schultz saved Southwest 1380. Virginia Muir tweets, Hashtag hero pilot who landed the commercial plane after an engine blew up is a hashtag veteran. Schultz was one of the first female fighter pilots for the U.S. Navy. The Reagan Battalion tweets, this audio between the ATC and heroic female pilot Tammy Jo Schultz, who safely landed the Southwest jet after one engine exploded earlier today, is incredible. This woman is cool as a cucumber. The audio has been posted on YouTube. And that is a look at social media.
All right, that's Sarah, International Edition, Sarah Williams. We invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. U.S. lawmakers urge a global effort to counter online terror funding. America remembers Barbara Bush. Pakistani journalists are condemning the curbs on the media. And NASA's rocket with a planet-hunting telescope lifts off. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. On Wednesday, Saudi Arabia unveiled its first movie theater in over 35 years with a private screening of the blockbuster Black Panther, the first in a series of trial runs before theaters open to the wider public there. The gala event comes after the conservative kingdom lifted the ban on cinemas as part of a far-reaching liberalization drive, with U.S. giant AMC Entertainment granted the first license to operate movie theaters. Ali Shahabi, executive director of the Arabia Foundation in Washington, says this is pretty significant.
Well, it is extraordinary because it is bringing fun back into society and back into life for youth. The religious establishment, you know, had sort of worked very hard to make life a bit dry for youth in Saudi Arabia. There weren't many avenues for entertainment, hardly any, actually. And I think the Crown Prince is working very diligently and actively to bring entertainment back into the country, to create for the young men and women of the country multiple opportunities to have fun also, you know, to enjoy life in their country and not to feel that they have to escape to surrounding countries to find entertainment, and also to give them something positive to do with their free time. You know, it's one of those things that religious conservatives decided that they didn't like, although it was never really thought through correctly because there's nothing about movie theaters that is unreligious. But these things become wedge issues that conservatives hold on to. And they find all sorts of reasons why it should be prohibited. It's very easy to prohibit something. And I think what the Crown Prince is doing is he's breaking these obstacles, really, because there was no logic behind not allowing them. And he is, you know, bringing this, like allowing women to drive also was another wedge issue. Preventing women driving had no religious logic to it, but it had been a rule for the last 50 years. So he's breaking these outdated conventions and bringing in a lot of social liberalization into society.
Well, the reform also stems in part from economic motives, as the kingdom reels from an oil slump since 2014, and Saudis currently do splurge billions of dollars every year to see films and visit amusement parks in neighboring tourist hubs like Dubai and Bahrain. Well, 8 years ago today, April 20th, the United States suffered a disastrous oil spill, the largest in American history. 11 people died. The Gulf Coast lost $23 billion in tourism-related income, and thousands of marine mammals and birds perished. The industry also lost tens of billions of dollars, and the nation saw billions more in environmental damage. Now, on the anniversary of the accident, environmentalists are worried it could happen again, as the Trump administration proposes opening all of the nation's coastlines to oil drilling and exploration, including areas permanently protected under the law. Joining us now from Alaska is Eric Graff with the environmental group Earth Justice. What do you think that the lessons have been since the BP oil disaster?
Well, I think that the Deepwater Horizon showed how dangerous and out of control the offshore drilling is and the industry had become. And since that time, there have been some strides made in the years following with some stricter regulations that were meant to control blowouts better, the types of things that failed and caused the Deepwater Horizon spill. But in general, offshore drilling remains very dangerous, a high-risk endeavor, and that's true in the Gulf of Mexico, and it's especially true in the Arctic Ocean. There's just no way to turn offshore drilling into something that isn't a very risky endeavor.
I remember watching as this scene played out for days with this oil just pouring into the Gulf. And I'm wondering now, all these years later, because I know we had marine mammals that were that perished, birds that perished. We had birds that had oil on them. We had marshes that were, you know, just devastated. It was a really horrific environmental crisis. Has it recovered? Has the wildlife recovered? Has the environment recovered?
The short answer is that we're still learning, right? You know, people are still learning about long-term effects that that are manifesting now. And for, you know, I know a little bit more about the Exxon Valdez spill, which was in 1989 up here in Alaska. And still now, to this day, the effects are felt and populations haven't returned to what they were pre-spill, like of herring and orcas. And there's still oil on the beaches. You can dig and find oil. And that's 30 years ago almost. So these spills have really long-lasting effects, and I think the same is true of the Gulf. That, you know, people are still—we're still learning what the effects are and how long-lasting they will be.
We've heard a lot about the Trump administration looking to drill, particularly in the Arctic, along with some other coastlines in the U.S. I would imagine that there's some pushback from that from environmentalists.
Absolutely, it is sobering on the anniversary of the Deepwater Horizon disaster to be facing an administration which has put out a plan to open up all of the oceans around the United States to offshore oil drilling. So they want to open everywhere to oil drilling. They're proposing a plan that would hold the most offshore oil and gas lease sales ever proposed. And that's really sobering. And at the same time that they're offering all of our oceans to the highest bidder, they are seeking to roll back regulations that were put in place after the Deepwater Horizon to curtail some of the worst abuses of the industry that led to that disaster. They're opening up everywhere, including in the Arctic Ocean, which is the last place on Earth you'd want to drill for oil. And they're stepping on the gas there, proposing annual lease sales in an area, Chukchi in the Beaufort Sea, that was specifically closed to oil and gas drilling after, by the previous administration, a decision that was supported by million Americans and the science.
Are we drilling at all in the Arctic right now?
There's no offshore drilling in the Arctic Ocean. Currently, the vast majority of the Arctic Ocean was placed permanently off limits by the Obama administration. President Trump has sought to put aside those permanent protections, but that decision's being challenged in court.
There have been a lot of growing concerns about the Arctic just in general with climate change and the ice melt. We already know it's a fragile ecosystem. Now there's concern that there could be offshore drilling. What would be the biggest concerns with that?
The Arctic Ocean is the last place on Earth that we should be drilling for oil. It's ground zero for climate change, and the animals there are, which depend on sea ice for their survival, like walrus and polar bears and seals, are under tremendous stress, adding another stress of large-scale industrial activity like offshore oil drilling to that be catastrophic. It's also possible to clean up an oil spill were one to occur in the Arctic Ocean. And the government itself has said that if oil and gas leases are fully developed in the Arctic, there's a 75% chance of a major oil spill. So if there's oil development, there will be oil spills, and they can't be cleaned up in the Arctic Ocean because of its remoteness and because of its icy and stormy seas and darkness. As we saw in the Deepwater Horizon, even under relatively placid warm conditions, you can't clean up spilled oil in the ocean effectively at all. In the Arctic Ocean, you would be even less able to clean up an oil spill were one to occur. And then finally, even if oil and gas could be developed safely in the Arctic Ocean, it wouldn't come to market for decades. And we have to be transitioning rapidly away from fossil fuels if we are to avoid the worst impacts of climate change. So any of this oil would come to a market at a time when we have to be well on our way off fossil fuels to avoid the worst effects of climate change.
That's Eric Graff with the environmental group Earth Justice. Thanks for being with us. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning in to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. Well, Senegal has a small but ambitious circus. It began as a local association offering arts and acrobatics workshops to disadvantaged kids from poor neighborhoods around the capital. The circus troupe has grown from there and now performs abroad, though some of the acrobats continue to face resistance from their families. Chika Odua reports for VOA from Dakar.
Flipping, swinging, contorting their bodies. These young acrobats are members of Senegal's first homegrown circus called San Cirque. They come here several days a week to practice. 22-year-old Mati Nyang is a university law student. She says her parents do not want her in the circus.
My father is not okay with it. He thinks what I'm wearing is tight and too sexy. It's because he's an imam, so I understand. I go out for training without their permission, and when I come back home, I ask for their forgiveness. I have to follow my passion, and this is what I love.
Trained in gymnastics and martial arts, Mati is one of the most talented acrobats in the group.
She's very hardworking. She knows what she's doing. The best thing for her father to do is to support her.
Modu Fata Touré founded San Cirque in 2010 to help disadvantaged youth. As a boy, he spent 5 years living on the street before he was taken to a children's home. And it was there that he met the Swedish circus performers who would go on to train him.
If someone helps you, you're supposed to then help other people who are also struggling.
San Cirque has opened doors the young performers say they never dreamed of, like traveling abroad. In 2015, they performed at the first African Circus Arts Festival in Ethiopia. The group has been on the move ever since. San Cirque started with support from a Swedish cultural association, but is now self-funded, relying on performances to earn money. Abdoulaye Ba joined the circus in secret, running away from home. He said members of his ethnic group, the Fulani, consider the performances with their drumming and dancing to be contrary to Islam. Abdoulaye does not regret his choice.
Being an acrobat gives me a lot of experience, also a lot of encouragement, a lot of motivation, mentally, physically, and emotionally. I'm working hard to show what I really love to do.
Practice ends with his favorite part, performing in front of children, whom he hopes to inspire to pursue their own passions, no matter how high they may seem. Chika Odua for VOA News in Dakar.
Well, Starbucks announced Tuesday it will close thousands of its U.S. stores on May 29th for staff training, following accusations that Starbucks employees discriminated against black people. Last week, a Starbucks store manager in Philadelphia called the police to remove two black men from the cafe because they sat at a table without making a purchase. Video footage of the incident went viral on the social media, sparking angry reactions. The company has issued an apology, and a top manager said Tuesday Starbucks managers across the United States will be receiving training on racial bias. VOA's Zlatika Hoke has the story.
Protesters mobbed a Starbucks cafe in Philadelphia after seeing a video showing policemen escorting out two black men. Their lawyer says they sat at a table waiting for a friend. And when one of them asked to use the restroom, they were told to purchase something or leave. A local police officer said the police was called after the men refused to leave.
Three different warnings to leave suggest that there wasn't a rush to judgment.
Many cafes and restaurants stipulate that their restrooms are for customers only, and to enforce the rule, they keep the doors locked. Customers have to ask for a key or an access code to open the door, but exceptions are made frequently.
I've gone into this very Starbucks and asked for the bathroom code, got the bathroom code, used the bathroom, said thank you, and left.
People also tend to sit in cafes for hours with their laptops and do not necessarily make a purchase.
I sat in there the other day for an hour. No one asked me to order anything or leave.
The incident on Thursday received a lot of media attention, but a similar one videotaped in California in January did not. Brandon Ward said he was told he could not use the restroom before making an order, but a white man directly behind him got the access code to the restroom before purchasing his beverage.
If you have a policy, you should abide by those guidelines for everyone. You can't sit here and segregate things. So you might as well just put on the store with your policy, whites only, at the end.
The Starbucks management has issued an apology and announced training for all of its store managers.
There's training that we're going to do with our store managers, not only around the guidelines, but training around unconscious bias. What happened to those two gentlemen was wrong.
Starbucks has more than 8,000 company-operated stores in the United States. Zlatica Hoke, VOA News, Washington.
Well, that does it for today's International Edition. We thank you so much for joining us, and have yourself a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
70 years ago this month, the United States implemented the European Recovery Program, better known as the Marshall Plan, in an effort to stabilize war-shattered Europe and help it restore its industrial and agricultural production. Between April 1948 and December 1951, the United States poured $13 billion in direct investment into 17 Western European countries, including former foes Germany and Italy. In today's money, that's around $130 billion. It was one of the most successful U.S. foreign policy moves of the 20th century. The Marshall Plan, named after then-Secretary of State George Marshall, was even more remarkable when viewed in the context of what took place after other wars, said Assistant Secretary for European and Eurasian Affairs Wes Mitchell at the Marshall Plan's 70th anniversary commemoration. In most of history's previous wars, the victor had sought to either extinguish the vanquished or to restore its own national strength by drawing upon the resources of the conquered.
Rather than punishing our enemies or retreating from Europe's problems, as we had done in 1918, America's leaders chose to remain in Europe and to use our great national wealth to nourish and rebuild its shattered societies. As Secretary Marshall said in 1947, the United States would, quote, do whatever it is able to do to assist in the return of normal economic health in the world, without which there can be no political stability or assured peace.
After 1945, the task was one of creation, to forge new relationships and to bring to fruition a new reality that could not have previously been imagined. Today, our task is preservation, to rally and conserve the West as a realm of ordered liberty against threats that few could have dreamed possible in the heady days after the fall of communism, said Assistant Secretary Mitchell. Commemorations are important for reminding both sides of the Atlantic that Allied cohesion is of inestimable value, but also that it requires sacrifice to maintain. Our grandparents' generation grasped that fact after the Second World War. It is up to us to ensure that the peace and prosperity they helped to broker, and from which we have benefited in our lifetimes, is extended to future generations.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.
Thank you.